I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi there, and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage. Today, we're talking about Tiffany being acquired by Louis Vuitton, Uber losing its London license, and the two stocks we think Warren Buffett should buy. So I suppose we should start off today by wishing Happy Thanksgiving to all of our US listeners. Although I suppose by the time you listen to it, it's probably Black Friday. Emma, just to get us warmed up for today's podcast, can you guess how much money was spent by US consumers last Black Friday?
Oh my goodness. Okay. $1 billion.
Multiply that by six. $6.2 billion was spent by US consumers last Black Friday. So I'm going to guess that today is going to be a much bigger spend the US. So speaking of buying things, we've another company from our showroom has been acquired. Earlier this week, Tiffany's was acquired by LVMH. So this is a deal that there's been kind of rumors about for a while. For those who don't know, LVMH is more commonly just called Louis Vuitton, and it's the French company behind a lot of luxury brands like Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, Bulgari and Dior. So the deal that was announced on Monday is worth $16.2 billion, or about $135 per Tiffany share. At the start of the month, the rumours first came out about this deal when LVMH offered Tiffany's an all-cash takeover bid of about $120 a share, which would have valued the company at about $14.9 billion. This was rejected, but they obviously went back to the negotiating table and struck a deal. Emma, yeah. What do you think of this deal?
Well, firstly, I was kind of disappointed to see it because while it was our 12th, as you said, 12th acquisition from our hand-selected shortlist of great stocks, 11 of which resulted in great returns for anyone who bought them, I was disappointed especially in Tiffany because it was bought on the premise of being a multi-generational brand and that you could buy shares in Tiffany and hold them in your family's wealth casket, as it were, for generations to come, and that's so no longer is the case.
Well, when you think of Tiffany's, like it's one of those iconic brands. It's been around for over 100 years anyway, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, so. Yeah, actually, I think it's 12th century.
Really?
Is when...
Originally.
Yeah, wow. So it's a super old brand. The CEO, Bernard Arnault, I think you pronounce it.
Yeah, CEO of LVMH.
Yeah, of LVMH, sorry, I meant to say, he is actually renowned for acquisitions, and it was seemingly after the acquisition, he said, "We are the owner of a color. It's a pretty rare thing." So clearly he had his designs on Tiffany and that iconic cobalt, or what's the color? Is it turquoise? They have a name on it.
There probably is a Tiffany branded name.
There is, but he had an eye on that brand for the longest time. Yeah. And he is a renowned deal maker and was very focused on getting control of Tiffany to join that house of brands, the greatest iconic premium brands in the world.
Well, we were talking about it in the office when the deal came through, and you know, people were asking, you know, why would you buy Tiffany's? And in one word, it is the brand.
It's just such a powerful brand.
I was reading before we came up that there's actually a black market that operates for the sale of the Tiffany blue boxes. So not talking about the jewelry or anything else Tiffany sells, it's actually people sell the boxes on for, you know, $50, $60.
The
boxes. I've heard of that with Apple before too, I think.
Yeah, and when you think of LVMH, Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy, they have 75 existing premium brands.
Yeah.
So that is one hell of a roll call of brand names that are up in that bracket that don't discount in a recession. They don't discount per market. They have the pricing power. And that's the great thing about being the owner of a premium product that's perceived as premium. You don't go to a Ferrari showroom on Black Friday because
exactly.
You'll pay the same as you would on the 1st of January. What was really interesting to me was that LVMH did not involve any banks in negotiating its biggest ever deal.
So that's abnormal for an acquisition like this, is it?
It is, yeah. I mean, when you think about the complexity of the acquisition, clearly there's legal complexity, but there's pricing complexity, and that LVMH has now not only got the financial strength, but the acquisition know-how to actually move in and acquire brands such as Tiffany's without having to involve a third-party advisor whose speciality is acquisition and the financing thereof.
So it's probably worth pointing out then that if you are a Tiffany shareholder, that this was an all cash deal, which means that instead of getting equity in LVMH, you're just going to get the cash from the deal whenever it does close into your brokerage account. And as you mentioned, Tiffany is the 12th stock to leave our app, and we have a return of just over 90% on it. So not too bad, but I think we would have liked to hang on to it for a little while.
It would have done better had it just sat there for us, but that's the way the cookie crumbles.
The way cookie crumbles. Moving on then, and some other pretty big news this week involves a company that's not in our showroom, but it's one we talk about an awful lot, that's Uber. So on Monday, it was announced that Transport for London, which is the governing body of the city, had refused the renewal of Uber's operating license in the city. This is pretty big news, as London is Uber's largest European market, has about 3.5 million users in the city, and it comes after the company was accused by TfL of a pattern of failures on safety and security with regards to passengers. Specifically, the TfL seems to be accusing Uber of allowing over 14,000 journeys by drivers operating on falsified accounts. So it appears that maybe some drivers who were suspended or were unable to operate under their own account for any other reason were using friends' accounts and just changing the profile photo and stuff like this. As anyone who's been kind of keeping up with Uber as of late will know, this isn't Uber's first run-in with authorities in London. So back in 2017, the company had their license renewal rejected due to their approach in reporting serious criminal offences and driver background checks. So again, this kind of whole question of checking the people who are actually driving these cabs is getting Uber into a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and when you think about the traditional old world taxi business, where a driver needed to be licensed and have specific ID that was handed out by governing body, you can see there's going to be speed bumps in the disentanglement of these industries.
Yeah.
And in all the platform businesses that are out there parallel to Uber, you can see similar kind of things happening and on a per market basis. So I can't speak to the accuracy of the reasons that you just explained, James, but what we do know is that behind every old world business is a giant lobbying body who has strengths and influence beyond what is seen. And again, I'm implying that there was some kind of darker, deeper influencing force behind it, but what I'm actually saying is I just don't know. But it is a blow to Uber, because other markets are going to sit up straight and reconsider what's happening in their markets. So the level of governance, if you like, per market, I think is going to come down pretty heavy now, because London is a hell of a big city to lose.
Exactly. And I think there is also an element of Uber's past kind of coming back to haunt them in this too. So under the former CEO, Travis Kalanick, who also founded the company, Uber had a very kind of abrasive image. You know, they got in trouble a lot. They kind of tended to do things and ask for apologies later.
Yes.
Ask for forgiveness later.
Yeah.
So it seems that, you know, this might not have been as big of an issue, the current problem, as past ones, but that just given Uber's reputation, that authorities are just coming down pretty hard on them. Mm. Personally, talking around the office, I know here in Dublin, we're quite close to London. It's kind of a short hop across. And anytime I've been in London, you either use the tube or you use an Uber. There's kind of no other transport to use. So this would be a massive blow. And I can see a lot of actual Londoners not being too happy with it too. So I'm not convinced that they will be banned from the city.
Yeah, actually, I mean, we have a lot of friends. My Wall Street has a lot of friends in London City. Hello, Derek and Daniel and family. And they are huge advocates of Uber. And in the past, when I've been over in London on business, had conversations about the very company and its flotation and stock. And really what I got from those conversations was how integrated Uber is in their lives.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you can extract that without a degree of kickback from the wider community. So let's just see how it plays out. Mm. It's a pity, because I think the new Uber CEOs wanted to be, like, was working for a legacy that was one of cleaning up the whole act.
Yeah, there's a lot of damage control.
There's a lot of damage control. He took over. I mean, like, I swear, if you're going to take over a job...
why not Uber?
Like, if you're trying to recover a reputation, no better place to start than after Travis Kalanick. But
yeah, but it's just, I suppose, the long and short of it is it's just another problem for Uber. You know, they're facing such problems in the domestic market with the likes of Lyft and stuff. And
yes,
they really don't want to be getting in more trouble in European markets. I was actually taking a look. Uber doesn't really exist in Ireland. Rory was talking about this during the week, that we have the Uber app here, but it's not Uber X. So if you order a cab or whatever from our Uber app, you just get a normal taxi. It's not the ride sharing element.
No.
But I was kind of looking wider across Europe, and the company has already been banned in a few markets in Europe. Probably most noticeably is in Copenhagen and Denmark.
Oh, really?
Don't allow Uber at all.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's
and the rationale for that ban, what was
I'm not sure. I think they just from the outset didn't want Uber, and it's probably along the same lines of the usual criticisms they get.
Yeah.
So one more story that I want to get to before we move on to our company we never talk about is PayPal. So last week, PayPal made its largest acquisition ever, buying the shopping and rewards program Honey for $4 billion. This is PayPal's fifth acquisition in the last 2 years. And it will insert the payments giant into another stage of the online shopper's journey. So what Honey do basically is that they find it's a tool that finds the best deals available for shoppers for certain products online. And then when you get to kind of the checkout part of your customer journey, it automatically inserts all the coupon codes or deals or whatever else into your customer cart. I think the really interesting thing about this, though, is that, you know, it's another acquisition for PayPal. So five in the last 2 years is pretty significant. And PayPal, if you can say one thing about them, you can say a lot. But if you say one thing, is they're really, really good at acquisitions.
Yeah, they are. The race to cashless society and the race to dominate your wallet is apparent in pretty much every first world market. And PayPal had a first mover advantage, but they were throttled, I suppose, by their corporate owners, which at the time was eBay. They spun off and then they were free to really go their own way. And I've admired the business, as have you, I believe, James, and many others around my Wall Street HQ. I think... what we're seeing here now is going deeper. You know, the need to go deeper into that wallet is with deep analytics is what we're seeing with all these different businesses now.
Yeah.
And then on the flip side of the coin, if you excuse the pun, I saw Deliveroo, who were the original PayPal. Deliveroo is a business that prints paper money. They are the de facto standard in printing paper money. And you can buy shares in Deliveroo. So if you go to your local central bank, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, I'm not so certain if Deliveroo have a global monopoly, but Deliveroo's share price over the last 5 years has been crushed. And it is almost now, actually, sorry, it was reported recently that Deliveroo is on the brink of bankruptcy. The guys who print money are nearly bankrupt. And I just thought, well, PayPal, Square, Revolut, take a bow, because these players together are really damaging. Now, there's other elements to the Deliveroo story. Seemingly, Brexit is hurting them, but really, there is less printed money required. And and as we see these acquisitions with PayPal and Honey and all the ones that preceded it, Venmo and Braintree and all those other, like, it really is a consolidation of intelligence.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is a very disruptive force. We had a debate over lunch, James, about the Revolut card and how great it is and why it's great. And next thing, there's conversations happening about the alternatives. And I think we all use PayPal. I think we'll all continue to use it. And good luck to them.
Yeah, and absolutely. And with these acquisitions, I think we're using PayPal even when we don't really know we're using PayPal. So there's the obvious, you know, your PayPal account. But, you know, they recently bought, I think it was last year, they bought iZettle, which was previously their biggest acquisition ever at $400 million. And iZettle was often called the Swedish Square. So what they do is they provide point of sales technology and invoicing software and stuff like this. So, you know, they're getting both sides of the cash register, the merchant and the seller.
Yeah.
And it's just that kind of literally getting a tentacle or an arm into every aspect of the customer
journey. It is
amazing.
It's very
impressive.
Is amazing. Yeah.
So that was PayPal. Let's move on now to the company we never talk about. Emmett, this week we're going to discuss Casey's General Store.
Yeah. So Casey's General Store, let's remind ourselves of who Casey's are and what they do. Casey's is headquartered in Iowa, in the US, of course, and it operates more than 2,100 convenience stores in 16 Midwestern states. And what their business is, there's three-thirds to the Casey's business. One-third is they sell self-service gasoline. They have a wide selection of grocery items, and then they have an array of freshly prepared food items like pizzas and donuts and subs and sandwiches.
Yeah.
And they are an impressive business. They're the fourth largest convenience store business in America.
Wow.
So they are not just the guys who you go to fill up the tank. They are the fourth largest convenience. That's huge.
That's crazy. That is, yeah.
It is amazing considering. So their enterprise value, circa $7 billion. And in the year that was, well, is 2019, 650 million customers. So they have a big footprint. They're a big operation. And you know, as part of that operation, they operate two distribution centers, which basically delivers 90% of all the stuff they sell in store and distributes three quarters of all the fuel they sell. So that's Casey's. We've had it in the app for, well, I actually think since we launched My Wall Street, it's up about 30%.
Yeah.
Since we added it to the app, which I think was in the very earliest days. And for me, I've found Casey's, the reason I suggest we talk about Casey's today is not only because it's a company we never talk about, but because I was on the phone to a very nice, mature gentleman in Omaha during the week, where in the course of the conversation, he lamented not buying Casey's when he first thought about it.
Yeah.
And he mentioned to me that their pizza is really, really good and that it's a brand that's been there most of his life. He drives past Casey's or drives into Casey's on a very regular basis. And it reminded me that here in Dublin, we don't very often... We don't get exposure to the businesses that we very often analyze and talk about and experience.
It's, one of the things we often say is, you know, buy what you believe in or buy the companies that you interact with most often.
But yeah.
while that's a good kind of thing to say, it can often leave you isolated from other good investments.
Yeah. I mean, everything we derive about Casey's is from the written word or the occasional conversation.
Yeah.
And other bigger brands than Casey's are the case. Like, we talk about Square. We've analysed Square. We've thought about Square. I have never seen the Square brand anywhere in Ireland once.
Yeah.
Have you?
No, I don't think definitely their Cash App and stuff like that. Like, our alternatives are things like Revolut.
Exactly, yeah. So there is a creative isolation, I like to call it, by living on an island in the Atlantic, where it brings advantages as much as it brings disadvantages.
Absolutely.
And I felt that Casey's was a prime example that in the middle of North America sits the fourth biggest retailer, and while I've never seen it in my life, there's a reasonable chance I never will.
Yeah.
So what's happening with Casey's? So it's a company where a whole lot of stuff doesn't happen. Like, it's a pretty sleepy investment. So it was relatively interesting that they recently appointed a new CEO, Darren Rebelles, who says he sees great potential for longer term growth. He came from the IHOP chain, which I think is a pancake house.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, not to be too judgmental, I believe it's probably just as well we don't have it in Ireland, because I did look up to see where IHOP reviews good, and they're not.
Okay.
well, at least the ones I read weren't. But we won't certainly judge the man on that, because as we well know, we've seen former CEOs take over new businesses, like Taco Bell's former CEO took over Chipotle and drove...
The best example you
best
could.
Best example. I mean, he drove Chipotle to dizzying heights when he took over. So bringing in a new CEO with stripes on their arm from a previous chain can have a very transformative and refreshing effect on a business. And I would say specifically multiples like Casey's. But I'm not excited by it. I wouldn't be a huge buyer of Casey's right now. Multiple of sales. Like, I think I did a quick back of the envelope last night. It's trading about 40 times adjusted earnings.
Okay.
And that's well above its historic average, which tends to be between, I don't know, about 30-fold. So I think that the business is really... hanging its hat, as it were, on a couple of new strategies.
Okay.
But at the end of the day, what Casey's does, and one third of its revenue is gasoline, fresh food and groceries. And there's only so many ways to innovate there. But specifically where the new CEO sees the ability to widen his share of the wallet is with a fleet card or a loyalty card.
Yeah.
Which, as we know,
worked for Chipotle.
Worked for Chipotle. It works for Ulta Salon. It works for Starbucks. It works for businesses. I think it's almost uniquely North American strategic priority. Over again on this side of the world, they don't see so much customer loyalty from programs, you know?
Yeah, not exactly. No,
I think it's more of an American thing.
You could kind of get stamps on a card when you get like 10 coffees and stuff.
Yeah,
like
and
that.
The stamps lie all over your wallets and the drawers in your office. And the second, so their fleet card is the first avenue for growth that they see, and the other is price optimization with a whole bunch of fancy software to put technical language around it. So I think that Casey's going to have to do more to renovate its existing stores, from what I can see, and to upgrade its commercial fuel business. So there's quite a lot of work to be done. I don't see Casey's. I think it will continue to be a fine stock that pays a dividend, that does well. It doesn't have a great disruptor sitting in the sidelines. And let me just get the statistic here. I have it written down somewhere. But like most of their stores lie in population, very low populated.
I think they're mainly based in the Midwest kind of region.
I think strategically they choose to go into areas with a low population, so it's uncontested marketplace. And I don't have the figures right to hand at the moment, but they have a good strategy. They've executed against it well. It has returned for people. It's a safe stock.
Yeah,
if you ask me.
Definitely one to keep an eye on with the new CEO.
It is. I mean, so from 2016, they've steadily increased their revenue. Mm. Revenue has grown from around $6 billion in 2016 to around $8 billion in 2019 in a steady step upwards. Not blowing your socks off, but hey, it's a nice business, and it is anything but a SaaS, and we spend a lot of time talking about software as a service companies, and this is the inverse of that.
That's a great point, that, you know, SaaS companies and technology companies tend to be very exciting, but you can't build your portfolio just on those either.
Yeah.
Cool. So that was Casey's General Store. Just to talk about a few of the things in the My Wall Street app at the moment, we've had a great run of new stock additions, with November's stock up more than 5% since we added it, and October's edition up nearly 30% since we added it. Our new stock of the month selection is ready to go live on Monday. This is a financial services company that's going from strength to strength in an increasingly cashless world, just what we were talking about, Emmett. Our last stock of the month is already up more than 16% since we picked it, so make sure to log into My Wall Street on Monday to check this one out. I'm also delighted to announce that we have a brand new service coming to the My Wall Street universe in the next few weeks. Emmett, do you want to say a few words?
Yeah, sure. So, well, I've been fortunate enough to have enjoyed some good long-term returns in my investing life. Like specifically my CAGR, our compounded annual growth rate, has been 21% for 19 years versus single digits for the benchmark S&P 500 in the same period. And as you all know, I'm not inordinately intelligent. I'm just quite obsessed with the subject. So Horizon, our new product, is a project where I'm going to start with cash and build a portfolio from scratch in the hope and intention that I can sustain my 20-year returns for the next 12 years. And that would imply 10xing my money, multiplying my money, my investment, if you like, by 10 in that time frame. So basically, this is a long-term wealth creation project and is singularly the most requested project since we started My Wall Street.
Yeah.
So this product has been something that we just have heard month in and month out from people, which is they deeply value the products we've brought to market, but, you know, what are those guys doing?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
This is what this guy is doing. It's hugely time consuming. Horizon at this moment in life is consuming me. I'm reading and researching stocks night and day. It's something that's really personal because I'm investing a level of money that's not insignificant to my household. It's a lot of money to me. It's a lot of money to my home. And therefore, it is me managing my money, and people effectively can look over my shoulder shoulder if they choose to copy. That's their business. But I think that this is something I'm very excited about, and I've spotted a few stocks and opportunities that I'm deeply getting into at the moment. And because it's a 12-year project, it's a very real piece of work for me.
Yeah. So to kind of put it beside the My Wall Street app at the moment, whereas My Wall Street is a shortlist that we curate regularly of stocks we really like and we're watching right now. This is stocks you are actively buying in. It's a peek into a portfolio pretty much.
The My Wall Street app, I will go to my grave believing it was the greatest value product ever brought to market.
Okay.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Because we spend so much work building a short list of some 10,000 listed companies to 100, and at the end of each month we appoint our one favorite, and you can live a very successful financial life, I believe, by just simply looking at stock of the month every month.
Yeah.
But Horizon is different because when it comes to the practicalities of, well, how much you're buying of this stock and when, that's what I'm personally doing. I'm declaring how much money I'm putting in, why, when. We stick to a publishing schedule in the My Wall Street app because you must. You know, you need a predictability to a product that only costs $10 a month. But for this, I will be buying when the time is right. I will be buying on dips. I will be using some other investment opportunities that just wouldn't be safe enough for the My Wall Street app. So small cap companies, probably now and again we'll use options, you know, but like in English mustard, very, very, very sparingly. It's a long-term project, and I have to acknowledge it's launching at the highest point in the history of the stock market.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to rush out and plow every penny I've got into 12 stocks in the first week or month. What this is going to do is deliver returns, and that's the basic bottom line with Horizon. It's not I'm managing someone else's money, I'm managing mine. And you can rest assured that my number one goal is to maximize returns, end of. Nothing else. I'll be obsessed on that.
Exactly. So that's Horizon. If you want some more information about Horizon, and if you want to sign up to our special introductory offer pricing, just follow the link into the notes for today's show. Right, let's move on to Jargon Busters. So we actually have one question for this week's Jargon Busters. And I suppose it's to kind of do with all the turnover in CEOs. So I read somewhere before we came up here that 2019 has been the highest year of CEO turnover in, I think, the history of the stock market.
Is that so?
Yeah. So Ivan sent us in an email and asked, when CEOs are removed or step down, but are then put as chairman of the company, what's the difference? So I suppose if you're thinking in recent news, you're thinking of people like Kevin Plank at Under Armour or Adam Neumann at WeWork, although I think he's completely departed the company now. But when a CEO is stepped down willingly or otherwise, but then become chairman, is there really any difference?
There is a difference. Yeah. The governance responsibilities of the two roles is different. And I'm not going to pull out the Institute of Directors rule book, but a CEO is in the thick of the action day in, day out, 7 days a week, and has all the heads of the C-level report to her or him. So they have a far more in-depth view of what's happening and will keep a tighter eye on the things relevant to this week, this month, this quarter.
Mm.
A chairperson is supposed to be more removed and less involved in the detail and generally not involved in the day-to-day running of the business, and can therefore take a more strategic view and provide leadership to the board. The CEO will generally report to the chairperson, and so the chair has, I suppose, greater power but less control, if that makes
less
sense.
Less involvement.
So the chairperson would be less concerned about new recruits than she might be concerned about how are we looking in 3 years from now, the strategic objectives of the business and the ability to get there. So to the question specifically, if a founding CEO leaves a business and becomes the chairperson, you have to think, well, they're really just keeping an eye on their baby.
Yeah, and I remember when, again, to talk about Chipotle, but I remember when Steve Ells stepped out as CEO and became chairman, I remember there was a lot of worries that, you know, he was kind of still going to be too hands-on with it, with his baby, the company he built.
Yeah.
But thankfully, that wasn't the case. But It also appears to me to be, it's a natural progression, I imagine, yeah, from any founding CEOs. To,
less pressure, I can tell you. I can see the where if it's done in the right spirit,
yeah,
I think it's a very good thing. So if you take the Steve Ells example, and I'm not privy to actually what happened there, but there was a point of realization in his head or those around him that he was not the man to bring the business forward. And as the founder, you truly only want this business to succeed.
That's it, yeah.
So if someone said to me as a founder of my Wall Street, excuse me, my experience is A, B and C and it's way better than yours, I'd be like, here, have a seat. I'm going to go become the chair. Seriously, all I want from my Wall Street is for it to succeed.
Yeah.
And if I had to leave this country for it to succeed and never talk of it again, I would do so. That type of passion only comes, I think, from a founding CEO.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can't but help think that when a founding CEO leaves and becomes a chair, it's because she or he has come to the conclusion that it's for the betterment of the business.
Okay.
So I frankly would not be as worried about it as the constant commentators who will write pieces about this is tantamount to corruption. I don't believe it is.
Yeah. Okay, cool. That was a good answer. So, Ivan, I hope that answered your question. Let's move on to the elevator pitch now. So, as you have probably noticed at this stage, it's only me and Emmett here today. There's no Rory.
Rory is sitting quietly in the corner, refusing to speak to us.
So, I'm going to step in for this week's elevator pitch. And the pitch is, so, in its recent earnings report, we learned that Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway is sitting on a cash pile of about $128 billion. And the question many people are asking is, when is he going to spend it, or what is he going to spend it on first? So the question I asked was, if you were Warren Buffett, what company would you be looking at to buy?
You go first, James.
Thanks. So I'm going to give myself 30 seconds because I don't know if I can talk for much more than 30 seconds. But the company I have picked is FedEx. So not the highest performing company as of late, but I think that if you're picking a company for Warren Buffett, or if you yourself are Warren Buffett in some alternate universe, you have to make sure it's a company you understand. That's one of the big markers he always uses for his investments. So Berkshire Hathaway already has a stake in a few logistic companies, including UPS, which is quite similar to FedEx, which shows that he definitely understands the business. He also has significant holdings in other kind of freight and airline companies like American Airlines and Southwest Airlines and things like that, which all ties somewhat into FedEx's business. As I mentioned, FedEx stock has been hammered recently over concerns about Amazon doing their own shipping and things like that. But I think, as we've talked about quite a lot inadvertently on this podcast, that the rising e-commerce tide is going to lift all boats eventually, and that people are still going to get their shoes and their Black Friday deals delivered to their door. So I think FedEx is, over the long run, a good investment for Warren Buffett.
Nice. Well, I have two answers. One is tongue-in-cheek and the other, I suppose, is less tongue-in-cheek. So the first answer, which is a little bit smug, and I mean it, is if I was Warren Buffett, I'd buy my Wall Street.
Okay.
Because we'd improve his returns.
There you go. I hope you're listening, Warren.
How long did that take? 30 seconds?
Yeah.
I suppose the other is one I've admired. But Warren Buffett buys what he likes. It doesn't have to be a publicly listed business. I think Airbnb is a mega brand.
Yeah.
And it's a mega brand in the waiting, and I think that they're doing something very special. I don't like to hear them discussed in the same conversation as Uber. So I just think Airbnb is a really, really good business culturally and in what they're doing and how they're doing it and how it's run. So yeah, I'd buy Airbnb.
What was Airbnb's last valuation?
You have me there. I think it puts 30 billion. I have 30 billion.
Yeah.
I have 50 billion. I'm not too sure. I know there was a big check went in. I think 30 billion.
So
yeah.
He'd have a bit of change left over.
He'd have a little change left over. Yeah. Well, he could use it from my Wall Street.
Yeah. There we go. So that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment. And if there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode, please make sure to get in touch. You can catch us on Twitter, that's at MyWallStreetHQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's P-O-D at MyWallStreet, MyWallST.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to the Stock Club too, and if you're enjoying it, please leave a review or a rating for us on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. From me and Emmett, happy investing and happy Thanksgiving.